What we're going to begin with, in a sense, could be called the evidentiary core of the official version of the JFK assassination. Now, basically, we're going to be talking about the single bullet, or as many critics of the Warren Commission have termed it, the magic bullet theory. Now, this is, as I said, the evidentiary core of the JFK assassination investigation. What it provides for as follows. The Warren Commission conceded that three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade. Now, the first shot, they said, basically, well, one shot blew Kennedy's head completely off and was the fatal wound. That is very visible in the Zapruder film. Another shot missed the motorcade completely, struck a curb, and wounded a bystander named James Tague on the cheek with either a piece of stone, flying stone, or a piece of the bullet itself. That accounts for two of the shots. One shot misses completely, hits the curb, wounds James Tague. One shot blows Kennedy's head right off and kills
the top,
JFK.
The top of his head.
Now, there that leaves a third bullet, and that bullet alone to account for all seven non-fatal wounds in President Kennedy and then Governor of Texas John Connally, who was riding in front of President Kennedy. Now, there are seven non-fatal wounds to be accounted for by one bullet. If a second bullet has to be required to make those wounds, the entire Warren Commission's thesis goes out the window because the feat of marksmanship that is attributed to Oswald was impossible. Even the Warren Commission admitted it would have been impossible had a fourth shot been uncovered.
Yeah, just to break it down a little more simply, because again, this is very important, understanding the single bullet theory. That literally the entire Warren Commission's thesis is banked on the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin acting by himself. Nobody else had anything to do with it whatsoever. Now, as Dave said, this entire thesis is banked on the fact that there were three shots fired. And there's without going into details, the Warren Commission waffled back and forth on this for a long time. They would have liked to have attributed more shots to Oswald as actually having hit Kennedy and Connally. However, the evidence of the bystander, the chipped curb and all that, forced them into a position of realizing they had to admit one had missed the motorcade. Now, it is physically impossible for more than three shots. It's doubtful even that three shots could have been fired by Oswald in the time he was given, and there's a lot of information on that too. But it is physically impossible with the type of gun he had, the action that it had, the rate the motorcade was moving, proven beyond a shadow of a doubt by all physical means, literally impossible for Oswald to have fired a fourth shot. Difficult for three, literally and totally physically impossible for four. So hence, the single bullet, as Dave said, has to account for all of those seven non-fatal wounds, or else there is de facto, even the Warren Commission admits this, de facto a second person shooting at the presidential motorcade.
Okay, now, with regard to the single or magic bullet theory itself, the thing to remember about it is that with the single bullet theory, as with all of the other major aspects of the assassination of President Kennedy, the official version, it is not only wrong, it is wrong, but it is physically impossible in all of its major respects. Now, in witness to that, consider the following. First of all, the total amount of the material that was located in the various wounds, the seven non-fatal wounds attributed to the magic bullet, which, by the way, was called Commission Exhibit 399. You may hear it also referred to as CE-399. Now, CE-399 left bullet fragments in many of the seven non-fatal wounds, as well as some fragments in the car itself. Now, a total of the bullet itself, CE-399, was not only virtually undeformed in that the only material missing was taken from its base, not from its nose. It was not only undeformed, but there was a total of about 2.4 grains missing from the bullet. Now, a piece of lead was recovered from Governor Connally's wrist alone, and there were other pieces recovered. The piece from Connally's wrist alone weighed 3 grams. Now, obviously, the sum of the parts is equal to the whole. Now, the whole is equal to the sum of its parts. Under no circumstances can the sum of the parts be greater than the whole. This is a very basic principle of mathematics, and this principle was thrown out the window in order to arrive at the magic bullet theory. It's one of many reasons why it has been termed that. Keep in mind that there are only 2.4 grains missing. The largest of the many fragments that had to have come from this bullet, if the Warren Commission's thesis is correct, it in and of itself weighed 3 grams. In addition to that, the bullet makes several sharp, and in some cases right-hand turns in midair without being acted upon by another object. Now, this is a direct contravention of the law of inertia. Obviously, a body that is in motion tends to stay in motion unless acted upon by an external force. The same thing goes for a body which is at rest. This was also tossed out the window by the Warren Commission. Now, something to keep in mind. You may see in ballistics demonstrations or material about ballistics, you may see bullets following a very strange path, which they sometimes do. They often follow strange paths in what are known as fascia, layers of tissue. They will do all kinds of strange things in a human body. They do not execute sharp turns when acted upon by nothing in mid-air. You know, it's important to note the difference because bullets do weird things in various mediums like flesh. They don't execute right-hand turns in mid-air in direct contravention of the law of inertia. That's one of a number of physically impossible assertions that the Warren Commission credits this bullet. And as I say, if you take out any one of these aspects, the whole Warren Commission thesis goes down the tubes. Now, we're going to get into a section of a Hard Rain show. Hard Rain is a program that I do here on KFJC. This original program, the program you're about to hear an excerpt from, was aired January 4th, 1981. So this is almost 3 years ago. Those of you who'd like to pursue this information further, as Nipper indicated at the top of the hour, tune in other KFJC programs. Now, the first thing you're going to hear here is an excerpt from a book called Whitewash Volume 2. Whitewash Volumes 1 through 4, plus a couple of other excellent books, were authored by one of the premier researchers of the Kennedy assassination, a man named Harold Weisberg, who is a former FBI agent and has done some yeoman-like work on this particular, on the JFK assassination, as well as the Martin Luther King assassination. And along with his attorney, a man named James Lazar, L-A-S-A-R, they published an excellent series of books, again, called Whitewash, Volume 1 through 4, also a book called Oswald in New Orleans. And what you're going to be hearing now is a brief thumbnail description of some of the things that the magic bullet did. And after that, you're going to hear a number of other things which we'll sum up afterward. Now, listen very closely to the information that's going to be presented here. Tape it if you're in a position to do so, because you're going to hear excerpts from some secondary sources and also elements taken directly from the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits. And this is part of the record, so if you'd like to preserve part of it, stay tuned. Once again, the very first, tape what you're going to be hearing. The very first segment here is going to come from book, as I said, Whitewash Volume 2 by Harold Weisberg and James Lazar. Well, Harold Weisberg, the researcher whose work I read you from just a minute ago, in that same book, in Whitewash Volume 2, describes still another supernatural feat performed by the magic bullet. Weisberg writes, "This bullet, after inflicting the other six injuries, had to have enough energy left to penetrate the governor's thigh for a distance not indicated in the report, about 3 inches, and at a point not precisely stated, to have embedded a fragment in his femur that still was in this bone at the time of his testimony, and then to have developed enough independent reverse energy to have unassistedly worked its way out of the governor's thigh without detection and to have gotten under, not on, but under a mattress on a stretcher that is in itself a separate mystery." Well, the mystery he's referring to here is the fact that it has been almost proven beyond debate that the stretcher from which the magic bullet was taken was not Governor Connally's stretcher at all, but rather that of a small child who had been taken into Parkland Hospital with a bad cut on his chin, his name being Ronald Fuller. Well, for the remainder of this broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at just how the Warren Commission, and in particular, Warren Commission Counsel Arlen Specter, set about attempting to prove the single bullet theory. We're going to look at how Arlen Specter disregarded testimony that would have cast doubt on the single bullet theory. We're also going to take a look at how Specter and the Commission adjusted the trajectory of the bullet by 28 degrees. And we're going to wind up by taking a look at how Arlen Specter obtained testimony from the Parkland Hospital physicians that supported his single bullet theory. But before we get on to that, I'd like to go over one more indication that the single bullet theory was in fact impossible. And I'd like to go over the results of the neutron activation analysis of the various bullet fragments taken from all of the 7 non-fatal wounds. The results of the neutron activation analysis test disproved the single bullet theory. In 1976, author Carl Oglesby, O-G-L-E-S-B-Y, published a book entitled The Yankee and Cowboy War. The Yankee and Cowboy War was published, as I said, in 1976 by Berkeley Medallion Books. And Oglesby discusses the results of the neutron activation test. Oglesby writes, The commission produced out of its own inquiries the most technically conclusive evidence against the magic bullet theory, although the significance of this evidence may have been concealed from the commission by the FBI, which arranged for the test to be conducted for this commission by the Atomic Energy Commission. This test, neutron activation analysis, or NAA, involved the same technique that two Swedish scientists used to prove in 1961 that Napoleon had actually been murdered by gradual arsenic poisoning. The method is to bombard the specimen material with neutrons and then measure the emissions thus produced. The operating premise is that any difference in the atomic structure of two materials, however slight, will be observable in these emissions. This is why Allegheny County Coroner Cyril Wecht, W-E-C-H-T, describes NAA as, quote, one of the most powerful and sophisticated forensic science methods ever developed. In the current case, NAA was used to compare fragments of a bullet taken from Connolly's wrist and elsewhere with material taken from the nose of CE-399, the magic bullet. CE, by the way, is Commission Exhibit number 399. If the fragments and the slivers are from the same bullet, they will give off precisely the same emissions under neutron activation analysis. Until the success of Harold Weisberg's Freedom of Information Act suit in 1974, it was not known for a fact that NAA had been performed. Hoover reported that it had been, but knowingly or not, he concealed the significance of it in a letter to Warren's chief counsel Rankin dated July 8, 1964. By that time, Specter's draft of Chapter 3 of the report, setting forth the single bullet theory, had already been submitted to Rankin. As Wecht observes, Hoover's language, quote, has to be read in its entirety to be appreciated, unquote. So I follow him in repeating the letter in full. As previously reported to the commission, certain small lead metal fragments uncovered in connection with this matter were analyzed spectrographically to determine whether they could be associated with one or more of the lead bullet fragments, and no significant differences were found within the sensitivity of the spectrographic method. Because of the higher sensitivity of the neutron activation analysis, certain of the small lead fragments were then subjected to neutron activation analyses and comparisons with larger bullet fragments. The items analyzed included the following: C1, bullet from stretcher; C2, fragment from front seat cushion; C4 and C5, metal fragments from President Kennedy's head; C9, metal fragment from the arm of Governor Connolly; C16, metal fragments from the floorboard carpet of the car. While minor variations in composition were found by this method, these were not considered sufficient to permit positively differentiating among the larger bullet fragments, and thus positively determining from which of the larger bullet fragments any given small lead fragment may have come. Oglesby goes on to comment here. The boiling obfuscations of that last paragraph show us Hoover at his best. There is no way for the technically uninformed to know that in the NAA test, any difference is significant. If one could strip down Hoover's subordinate clause to its grammatical essentials, one would have the heart of the matter right enough. Variations were found. Therefore, the fragments from Connolly's wrist and CE-399 were not of the same bullet, which should have been obvious to grown men to start with from looking at bullet CE-399 with their two eyes open. Well, in order to justify the physically impossible, the commission went to a number of extraordinary lengths, and one of the things that they did was by systematically disregarding testimony which would have led away from their single bullet theory, which, as I said, was crucial to their finding that Oswald acted alone in assassinating President Kennedy. Arlen Specter himself took the testimony of former governor of Texas John Connolly, and Governor Connolly said that he is convinced that he could not have been wounded by the first shot because he heard the first shot and he was not aware of any injury. And I will read you the dialogue here between Arlen Specter and Governor Connolly. Bear in mind now that it is the first bullet which has to have been the so-called magic bullet theory. He will refer to the first, second, and third shots here. Shot one was the magic bullet theory. It had to have been in order for the commission's thesis to have been valid. So pay particular attention to his reaction to the first shot here. Oglesby writes, this, by the way, is also from the Yankee and Cowboy War. Warren Commission attorney Arlen Specter, the author of the single bullet theory, examined Connolly before the commission on April 21st, 1964. The exchange on this point went as follows. Mr. Specter, in your view, which bullet caused the injury to your chest, Governor Connolly? Governor Connolly, the second one. Mr. Specter, and what is your reason for that conclusion, sir? Governor Connolly. Well, in my judgment, it just conceivably couldn't have been the first one because I heard the sound of the shot. In the first place, I don't know anything about the velocity of this particular bullet. It was 2,000 feet per second. But any rifle has a velocity that exceeds the speed of sound, 600 to 700 feet per second. And when I heard the sound of that first shot, that bullet had already reached where I was, or it had reached that far. And after I heard that shot, I had time to turn to my right and start to turn to my left before I felt anything. It is not conceivable to me that I could have been hit by the first bullet, and then I felt the blow from something which was obviously a bullet, which I assumed was a bullet, and I never heard the second shot, didn't hear it. I didn't hear but two shots. I think I heard the first shot and the third shot. Mr. Spector, do you have any idea as to why you did not hear the second shot? Governor Connolly, well, first, again, I assume the bullet was traveling faster than sound. I was hit by the bullet prior to the time the sound reached me, and I was in either a state of shock or the impact was such that the sound didn't even register on me, but I was never conscious of hearing the second shot at all. Obviously, at least the major wound that I took in the shoulder through the chest couldn't have been anything but the second shot. Obviously, it couldn't have been the third, because when the third shot was fired, I was in a reclining position and heard it, saw it, and the effects of it, rather. I didn't see it. I saw the effects of it. So it obviously could not have been the third, and couldn't have been the first, in my judgment. Well, in addition to disregarding Governor Connolly's testimony, which would have indicated that he was not, in fact, hit by the first shot, which had to have been, as I said, the so-called magic bullet, the commission, and Arlen Specter in particular, pointedly disregarded the many, many witnesses in Dealey Plaza who said that they thought the shots came from the famous grassy knoll in front of Senator Kennedy, in front of President Kennedy, I should say. And in addition, a woman named many witnesses said that they saw someone running away from the grassy knoll or else saw someone in firing position behind the fence on top of the grassy knoll. One of the people who reported a person running away from the grassy knoll area was a woman named Jean Hill. And her testimony and Arlen Specter's treatment of that testimony was related in an essay called The Case for Three Assassins. And The Case for Three Assassins was co-authored by David Lifton, L-I-F-T-O-N, and David Welsh, W-E-L-S-H. And that essay was included in an anthology that we've used a great deal in the past on this broadcast. That anthology, as regular listeners could probably guess, is entitled The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. That was edited by Mr. Peter Dale Scott, Mr. Paul L. Hock, H-O-C-H, and Russell Stettler, S-T-E-T-L-E-R. And in David Lifton and David Welch's The Case for Three Assassins, Arlen Specter's handling of Mrs. Jean Hill's testimony is described as follows. Mrs. Hill testified that she had talked to a Secret Service man on the afternoon of the assassination, and that she had asked him, "Am I a kook or what's wrong with me? They keep saying three shots. I know I heard more. I heard from 4 to 6 shots anyway." She testified that the Secret Service man replied, "Mrs. Hill, we were standing at the window and we heard more shots also, but we have 3 wounds, and we have 3 bullets, an apparent reference to the 3 spent shells found on the 6th floor of the depository. 3 shots is all that we are willing to say right now." And that comes from volume six of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission Testimony and Exhibits, page 220 through 221. "As soon as the motorcade passed," Mrs. Hill testified, "she saw, quote, a man up there running or getting away at the tip of the slope." That from Volume 6, pages 210 through 213. Commission Counsel Arlen Specter had Mrs. Hill indicate the location of the running man on a hand-drawn sketch. The sketch appears in the hearings as Hill Exhibit 5. It is stamped with the notation Top Secret. Nobody knows why. That from Volume 20, page 158. Within hours of the shooting, a local newsman, James Featherstone, instructed Mrs. Hill not to mention that she had seen them at the running man. She testified, quote, "He said, you know you were wrong about seeing a man running. He said, you didn't, and I said, but I did. And he said, no, don't say that anymore on the air. He said, pause, that the shots had come from a window up in the directory, in the depository, excuse me, and for me not to say that anymore, that I was wrong about it." Now that from Volume 6, page 222. Well, in addition to disregarding testimony that would have led away from the single bullet theory, the commission resorted to a number of almost unbelievable maneuvers in order to prove, which, as I indicated before, was a physically impossible theory. One of the more interesting maneuvers that they went through in order to do this was the way in which they adjusted the trajectory of the so-called magic bullet by reducing the trajectory from 45 degrees to 17 degrees. The machinations involved are extremely complicated. I'm going to read those to you, but in particular, pay close attention to the author's analysis of the chicanery that the Warren Commission resorted to. The author in this case is a woman named Sylvia Marr. Her name and last name is spelled M-E-A-G-H-E-R. Ms. Marr was one of the better publicized of the early Warren Commission critics. She wrote a book entitled Accessories After the Fact. Accessories After the Fact was published in paperback by the Vintage Press in 1976, as was, by the way, The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. For those of you who want to pursue this research, that was also Vintage Press, 1976. Well, of Ms. Marr's discussion of the Warren Commission's unbelievable maneuvering in order to reduce the trajectory of the magic bullet from 45 to 17 degrees, Ms. Marr writes in Accessories After the Fact, saying, "Other anomalies cannot be ignored in an evaluation of the single missile thesis. The trajectory of the shots, for example. Arlen Specter, the assistant counsel who was primarily responsible for the medical and ballistics evidence, repeatedly posed to witnesses a hypothetical set of circumstances in which the shots that struck Kennedy and Connolly followed a 45-degree angle of descent. In his autopsy report, however, Dr. Hume said that the shots came from a point, quote, behind and somewhat above the level of the deceased, that from page 543 of the Warren Report, which does not seem to agree with a sixth-story window or a 45-degree trajectory. How did the commission establish the trajectory? According to the testimony and the report, it was established by taking an average of the angle from the window to the car between frames 210 and 225, which, after adjustment to allow for the 3-degree slope of the street, came to 17 degrees, 43 minutes, and 30 seconds, and by piercing stand-ins for Kennedy and Connolly with a rod held at that angle of descent. Thus, it is hardly surprising that the rod went through the stand-ins at points approximating, unquote, the sites of the wounds actually sustained by the victims. The disparity of almost 8 degrees in the trajectory of Connolly's wounds is written off to either a slight deflection of the bullet or a slight shift in the governor's posture. Thus, by virtue of these ingenious calculations, approximations, and speculations, a trajectory of 45 degrees is reduced to one of 17 degrees without regard for the physical law stating that the line between two fixed points, the book depository window and the car positioned at the Stemmons Freeway sign, is a constant. The Warren Commission has formulated a new law. The shots came from the book depository window and no other point in the universe. Everything else is mutable. To regard such capriciously fluctuating evidence as authoritative or authentic would be folly, all the more so when the testimony of the groundskeeper at Dealey Plaza, Emmett Hudson, reveals that one of the two fixed points, the Stemmons sign, had been shifted from its place after the assassination and removed completely by early in 1965. Nevertheless, Leslie Liebler, the counsel who examined Hudson, failed to ask a single question about the removal of the sign or to take the slightest interest in this provocative information. Consequently, we do not know if the sign was moved before or after the FBI reenactment tests of May 24, 1964, or for that matter, before or after the Secret Service reenactments of December 5, 1963. The repositioning and ultimate disappearance of the Stemmons sign is a mystery with ominous overtones. Having no interest in evidence which did not incriminate Oswald, the Warren Commission took not the slightest interest in the Stemmons sign and, needless to say, made no investigation into when and why it was moved. Well, perhaps the most amazing device that the commission resorted to in order to prove its contention that Oswald acted alone, and of course, as I've indicated many times, the single bullet thesis is absolutely central to that finding. Perhaps the most amazing thing they did in order to elicit testimony from the Parkland Hospital physicians that was consistent with their view was by, in essence, having them assume, for the sake of argument, that what they were saying was true and asking them, based on that opinion, based on those assumptions, what their opinion was. Those of you familiar with the controversy surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy are no doubt aware that one of the central bones of contention concerns the throat wound that President Kennedy sustained. According to the single bullet thesis, this would have had to have been a wound of exit, a bullet exiting President Kennedy's throat and then executing one of those right-hand turns in midair and striking Governor Connally. Well, the Parkland Hospital physicians all testified that, in their view, this was the throat wound was most likely an entrance wound. And so what, as I said, what Arlen Specter did was to have them assume for the sake of argument that, in point of fact, the neck wound had been inflicted by a bullet traveling from back to front through President Kennedy's body and, of course, from Kennedy's body into Connally's. And they then testified, well, obviously, if I assume that's true from the beginning, well, then that's what happened. Well, what the Warren Commission did was to take that testimony and put it in the report, the Warren report, out of context in order to support the single bullet thesis. These amazing somersaults are outlined, are actually dealt with in some detail, in the essay from which I read you a few minutes ago. That essay is The Case for Three Assassins, co-authored by David Lifton and David Welch, once again in The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. And of the Parkland doctor's testimony and Arlen Specter's manipulating of that manipulation of that testimony, authors Lifton and Welch write, because the outlines of the frontal throat wound were destroyed by an emergency tracheotomy performed in an attempt to revive the president, the only persons able to see the original throat wound were the staff at Parkland Hospital. Let us examine their testimony. Dr. Malcolm Perry. The wound was roughly spherical to oval in shape, not a punched-out wound, actually, nor was it particularly ragged. It was rather clean-cut, but the blood obscured any detail about the edges of the wound exactly. That from Volume 6, page 9 of the 26 volumes of testimony and exhibits. Dr. Robert McClelland. If I saw the wound in its state in which Dr. Perry described it to me, I would probably initially think this were an entrance wound. That from Volume 6, page 37. Dr. Ronald Jones. The hole was very small and relatively clean-cut, as you would see in a bullet that is entering rather than exiting from a patient. That from Volume 6, page 55. Dr. Charles Baxter. Judging from the caliber of the rifle that we later found or became acquainted with, this would more resemble a wound of entry. That from Volume 6, page 42. Registered nurse Margaret Henchcliffe, H-E-N-C-H-L-I-F-F-E, also thought it was an entrance wound. She testified that she had never seen an exit bullet hole that looked like that one. That from Volume 6, page 141. The Parkland staff clearly showed, this is Lifton and Welch writing here, the Parkland staff clearly showed by their testimony that they observed the throat puncture to have all the characteristics of an entrance wound, small and clean cut, and none of the characteristics of the usual type of exit wound, large and with jagged edges. But Commission Counsel Specter was not content to hear testimony on what the only doctors who had seen it observed of the wound. In his questioning, he asked each of them to assume that the bullet had traversed from back to front through the president via a fascia channel. Fascia are thin tissue membranes that connect muscle, undeflected without wobble or yaw. The doctors were then asked to express an opinion based on that type of passage as to whether the throat puncture was consistent with an exit wound. Typical was Specter's questioning of Dr. James Carrico, C-A-R-R-I-C-O. Permit me to add some facts which I shall ask you to assume as being true for purposes of having you express an opinion. First of all, assume that the president is struck by a bullet from a rifle at a time when the president was approximately 160 to 250 feet from the weapon, Oswald's range, with the president being struck from the rear at a downward angle of approximately 45 degrees. The Specter here seems to accept the angle cited in the FBI summary report instead of the angle of about 15 degrees shown in the artist's drawing, Commission Exhibit 385, which accompanies the autopsy report. This 45-degree angle would render the pass-through theory just that more ridiculous. Then Specter picks up. Let me reread this for you. He says, at a time when the president was approximately 160 to 250 feet from the weapon, with the president being struck from the rear at a downward angle of approximately 45 degrees, being struck on the upper right posterior thorax, assume further that the missile passed through the body of the president, striking no bones, traversing the neck and sliding between the large muscles and the posterior aspect of the president's body through a fascia channel, then exiting precisely at the point where you observe the puncture wound to exist. Now, based on those facts, was the appearance of the wound, in your opinion, consistent with being an exit wound? That from Volume 3, page 362. Dr. Carrico responded, with those facts, and the fact as I understand it, no other bullet was found, this would be, pause, I believe, another hesitation, an exit wound. That from Volume 3, page 362. Dr. Perry, who had given the vivid description of an entry-type wound quoted above, responded to similar questioning. With the facts which you have made available, and with these assumptions, I believe that it was an exit wound. That from Volume 3, page 373. It is obvious that such yanked-from-mouth testimony cannot be taken seriously as independent medical opinion. When questioned on whether the wound was caused by an entry or an exit, the doctors are asked to assume the wound to be an exit to begin with. Norman Redlich, R-E-D-L-I-C-H, who wrote Chapter 3 of the Warren Report, made liberal use of such testimony, safely out of context, to support the conclusion that the throat puncture was an exit wound.
Well, you heard the way that Arlen Specter, who at the time was a committee councilman, yanked the testimony from the mouth of the doctors, all of whom had said it appeared to them to be an entrance wound in the throat, and said, well, if it wasn't an entrance wound in the throat, if it was in fact an exit wound from the throat, would you agree that it was an exit wound? What can anybody say in that situation? Some other very important things to realize in terms of this. Now, bear in mind, what we're talking about here is the magic bullet. We are talking about the very same single bullet that is also supposed to have gone through John Kennedy, later then gone into John Connolly, causing several injuries, shattering a rib, shattering his wrist, and later dropping out onto the stretcher, which in and of itself is in some doubt, and having less material gone from it than were found in the car in President Kennedy and John Connolly. Now, in and of itself, not only is this hysterical as far as any kind of a legal fact, but on top of this, we have to deal with the fact that the most that they could yank, even yanked from the mouth testimony, the most they could get from any of the doctors was that if indeed the bullet had passed from back to front, based on that particular wound in John F. Kennedy's throat in the front, that the bullet would have just barely had the velocity to just barely work its way out of the throat and basically drop into John Kennedy's lap. And there was no possible way that it could have gone on to inflict shattering injuries in John Connolly. Another key part of this testimony that has to be dealt with is the way that, and again, I wish that this was television and we could show you the pictures of the blatant way in which the Warren Commission had to really force the issue to try and prove that indeed that this shot did come from the book depository window. Here they had a shot which, first of all, they had all the doctors who saw the body at the time in Dallas on the site said was an entry wound. Not only did they have to try and prove that it was an exit wound, they had to prove that this exit wound went from a spot which was shown not only by the doctor's testimony, but by John F. Kennedy's clothing to be somewhere down near his right shoulder blade, that it had to come from an angle above him, go into the shoulder blade, and then go up and exit out the front of his throat. Well, the way that they tried to do this was to claim that John F. Kennedy had his arms hunched up in such a way that his coat actually rose 6 to 8 inches, bringing the shoulder of the back of his coat right over, right below the shoulder blade, up to a position on the back of his neck just below his head. Well, I dare you to go out and get a jacket, and I'll explain even further in a second, but I dare you to go out and get a jacket and try and make a spot located below your right shoulder blade rise to above your neck by hunching your shoulders up. Not only that, but of course at the time that a lot of this was going down, the Zapruder film had not shown up, and of course the Zapruder film totally disproves the idea of John F. Kennedy's clothes being hunched up on his back, because the film of the shot itself of John F. Kennedy as he's being shot shows that he is in basically a normal sitting position. His clothes are not hunched up in any way. His coat collar is right down at the level of where the entrance wound would have had to have been an entrance wound, and in fact that the hole in his jacket would have been right back over his right shoulder blade, which in fact the first doctors who did the autopsy that made the Warren Commission look very bad, they said that that's where the hole was. So There's about 450 other things. We will talk about some of them, but right there is some of just a few more facts on the single bullet and the literal impossibility and the frantic effort on the part of the Warren Commission to force stubborn reality to fit into their rather imaginative mold for it.
Yeah, a couple of things. The not only was the initial autopsy report destroyed, but the attempt, see, the entire physical version of the assassination is completely wrong. Oswald has never been, there is no physical evidence whatsoever linking Oswald to the particular rifle. There is overwhelming physical evidence that that rifle could not possibly have hit anybody. At the time the Oswald supposedly shot this rifle, it had an uncorrectable sighting deficiency on it. And the grotesque anomalies with regard to the rifle itself, all of the physical circumstances go on from there. A point that's worth making is some of the personalities that were involved in this. Now, Arlen Specter, at the time of the Warren Commission, he was a counsel to the Warren Commission, has since gone on to become a United States Senator from Pennsylvania. Not only that, but he now sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee and is helping to decide who the federal judicial appointments are going to be. So if that helps you sleep well at night, more power to you. Another note along that same line, a man named Norman Redlich, R-E-D-L-I-C-H, who essentially wrote volume 3 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits, he was the man who quoted the doctor's testimony out of context. Basically, you'll recall that Specter said, all right, I'm going to ask you to assume some things as being true. Now, assuming these are being true, what happened? They said, well, obviously, if I assume that's what happened, then that's what happened, paraphrasing them, of course. Well, Norman Redlich quoted all of that information out of context. Norman Redlich is now the dean of NYU Law School. And this really brings us to one of the points that we hope to make here, which is that the Kennedy assassination, as we talked about last week, could be described by the metaphor of an hourglass, with basically the assassination itself representing the waste or the narrowing of the hourglass, and all of the events in the history prior to 1963 leading up to it could be regarded as the reservoir of sand to drip down through the hourglass. And the world today, the time since 1963, could be regarded as the bottom of the hourglass. And all of the figures involved in concocting this preposterous version of the assassination have since moved on and are very much with us today. Bell Herndon, an FBI agent who faked Jack Ruby's lie detector test, is now the head of the FBI's crime laboratory. Gerald Ford went on to become president, and so on. All of these people have moved up. William Coleman, another Warren Commission counsel, became President Carter's Secretary of the Treasury, or of Transportation, rather. So
I was looking something up. Did you mention what happened to Gerald Ford?
Oh, yeah. President of the United States, yes, after becoming Vice President. We're going to come back to Jerry next week and length and in detail.
Jerry Ford, who is also interesting because he was the, after the Warren Commission specifically forbade any of the people involved with the Warren Commission from writing books about the Commission's investigation and things of that nature, Jerry Ford, of course, went out promptly and wrote a book called Portrait of an Assassin, heavily smearing Oswald as a left-wing agent and using, once again, yanked from the mouth and taken out of context testimony from the Warren Commission. We're going to be talking about that in a moment. A couple of more things on the subject of the single bullet, and we could literally go on the single bullet and the resulting fallacies and discrepancies of the Warren Commission. We could go on with this all night long. And I really sincerely urge some of you to go out and just read some of the material on it. It is probably the most shocking evidence of jurisprudence perverted that you're going to find in the history of the United States and probably of a good portion of the Western world. It's really shocking the way that people were taken advantage of. A couple of other things, of course, and one of the key things that apparently that the people who were involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy were not prepared for was the Zapruder film, that somebody would actually be out and in the midst of all this shooting going on would actually be still rolling their movie camera and get a fairly clear picture of the actual moments at which the bullets struck John Kennedy and John F. Connolly. And the Zapruder film in and of itself has been a powerful, damning indictment against the Warren Commission. One of the main factors, of course, the point that the Zapruder film clearly shows John F. Kennedy's body being slammed backwards into his seat. And, of course, the Warren Commission desperately is clinging to the theory that all the shots came from behind. Well, I dare you to go out and find anybody, sit them down in a chair and give them a good hard shove from behind and see if you can make them fall over backwards. It just doesn't happen, folks. It's got to be pushed from the front.
One of the things, too, that's very striking about the Zapruder film is the fact that when the bullet hits, when the bullet which blew Kennedy's head off hits, his head, I mean, not to be gruesome, but his head literally dissolves into a very visible shower of fragments, which is blown backwards many feet back at the limousine. That is one of the most startling things you'll ever see. I've been in one live audience where the Zapruder film was shown, and everybody gasps physically. It was shown in slow motion, and people actually, you know, it really blows people away, so to speak. They gasp aloud when they see it. It's very dramatic. If this were TV, we could probably just show you the Zapruder film and go home, and then we'd invite anybody who still believed the official version to enter into some business negotiations with us. You know?
Now, if for some reason, if you're too lazy to get down to your library, or you're strapped for cash and you can't get out and buy some of these books, let me tell you, and we're going to talk a little later in the show tonight about Life magazine and their ongoing role, and their just incredible role, and it's almost laughable except for the gravity of the crimes involved, but Life magazine's role in subverting any questions about the truth of the Warren Commission. And Life magazine, predictably enough, the new edition, the new incarnation of Life magazine, in their November 1983 issue, which is on the stands right now, and I've got it right in front of me, the cover story is The Kennedy Assassination, 4 Days That Stopped America. Now, a little later on in the program tonight, we're going to give you some information on how Life magazine acted back in the 1960s about the Warren Commission. But just as sort of a study aid, any of you can get a hold of it, there's two very interesting things that will give lend some credence and will lend a little air of color and on-the-spot coverage to some of the things we're talking about tonight. One of them is on page 69. They have a little collage thing of exhibits from the Warren Commission. And one of the things they have in a little round aluminum box sitting on a pile of cotton, they have bullet number 399, CE bullet 399, the magic bullet. You can look at it for yourself. It is absolutely pristine. This is right in Life magazine, one of the biggest proponents of the Warren Commission. It is literally pristine. You can go buy the magazine tonight at your local convenience store and look at it. The bullet does not have a scratch on it. There is no material missing from it whatsoever. This is the bullet that caused 7 non-fatal wounds, shattered ribs and wrists, you know, and left scattered material all over the car and the bodies of the victims, et cetera, et cetera. Check it out. It's really entertaining. The other thing is, as Dave was mentioning, they on page 55 of this same issue, they excerpt just a few segments of film from the Zapruder film. And one of the things that is shown is John Kennedy, the actual moment of the fatal shot. He is leaning forward when the fatal shot strikes. His head is in his hands. He's leaning forward. Immediately after the fatal shot, his head snaps back into the side. You can see that, too. That's right there. It's excerpted from the Zapruder film. It's right in Life magazine, and they blithely talk, as they're talking about it, down at the bottom of the page, they explain how here he is shot from behind, the fatal shot striking the right rear of the skull. Well, again, you can take a look for yourself. The reaction of the head is instantaneous. It does not go forward and then come back. It immediately goes back, and that's shown right there in their excerpted pictures from the Zapruder film. So this is still going on. They're blithely talking about these things in a way that has no reference to reality whatsoever, and you can go check it out yourself.
Well, basically, that I think would be a good place to pause for a couple of minutes. Remember now that there were two killings, well, three killings really, including that of Oswald himself, but two killings that were attributed to Oswald, not only John Kennedy, but also that of Dallas policeman J.D. Tippit. And we're going to come back to Tippit and the so-called evidence linking Oswald to Tippit. Keep in mind, though, the contravention of, is it the proper word? Anyway, the negating of the law of inertia, the negating of the law that states that whole is equal to the sum of its parts, and so forth, because the greater crime, as we said, there are two real crimes here. One is the assassination, one is the cover-up. And the cover-up is not only the easier crime to detect, it is by far and away the most important, because keep in mind that all of our history books, every major institution of our society, every major news medium and publishing house has subscribed to this theory, which is nonsense, which is physically impossible in all of its tenets, and that, for an American in 1983, is the most important aspect of this whole thing.
Indeed. We've got about another hour or so of information, plus then a little later on, sometime after 8 o'clock tonight, we are going to be going to the phones up until the end of the show at 10 o'clock. You can have an opportunity to call in then and ask questions or whatever you might want to do to participate at 415-941-2500. Right now we're going to take a short musical break, and then we are going to come back and talk about not only the death of Officer Tippit, but the sort of witnesses and the sort of evidence that were mustered against Lee Harvey. Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of President John F. Kennedy. And we will, as I mentioned before, be right back.